Alex very nicely set the stage for some of the things I'm going to talk about today. So in the next kind of 45 minutes, I'm going to talk to you about kind of another. So there's been a lot of talk about using mutual information. You don't necessarily need to. You can include information from the population. What I'm talking about now is if, in addition to population samples, you have some idea of the relatedness among individuals in your population, what information can be gained from knowing pedigrees? So a quick reminder from yesterday, if you're dealing with genotype by sequencing data or RADseq data, you have lots of different sources of error, so you can get false variant calls from PCR errors, sequencing errors, or collapsed repeats. There have been a lot of different kind of ad hoc methods to try to filter out false variant calls. So people filter out missing data. If you have a lot of individuals for which genotypes are missing, this may be indications of allelic dropout or really low quality genotype calls. You can also try filtering based on extremely high read counts. So this is based on the idea that if you have different regions of the genome collapse into a single cluster, you might see really, really high read depth. People also filter based on Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, or looking for, especially in the case of heterozygotes. So if you have two regions of the genome collapse into one, what you would expect to see is that every individual in your population is going to look like a heterozygous individual. And so if you filter out based on Hardy-Weinberg or just look for excess heterozygosity, you might be able to throw out repetitive regions. So what I'm going to talk about in the next kind of half hour is an additional filter that you can use. So if you have information about families, so you don't necessarily need big complicated pedigrees, if you can perform crosses, as long as you have information on parents and offspring, you can look for patterns of Mendelian inheritance, and this can get you a long way. So what I'm going to talk about is a method that I've been working on in collaboration with Chris Van Hout and Srikanth Gaudapati, who are postdocs in Andy Clark's lab, and also Jen Grenier and obviously Andy himself. So what exactly do I mean by Mendelian inheritance? Let me walk you through an example. So true SNPs, for the most part, do not violate the laws of inheritance. They segregate normally. So here, there's a little caveat. I say mostly because I'm assuming that you have accurate pedigrees and that you know who, like, your parent offspring relatedness trios are accurate. I'm also assuming that there is no segregation distortion or, meiotic drive in your population. I'm also assuming that there aren't any de novo mutations that are arising in the offspring compared to the parents. So if you're specifically interested in meiotic drive or de novo mutation, this isn't really going to help you that much. But let me walk you through an example. So if you have a pedigree of, so dad is big A, big A, mom is big A, and AT, you have genotypes of the offspring. If the offspring are AA and AT, this kind of set of genotypes is perfectly consistent with Mendelian inheritance. You could have another family where here, if the parents are CC and AC, you know that it's impossible for the offspring of these two individuals to be homozygous for the A allele, right? Or have kind of a third allele arise. So in this case, a CG genotype would also be, so this would be inconsistent with Mendelian inheritance. And if you see this pattern, you might suspect that this particular site isn't actually in a true segregating variant site. Of course, you could also get situations where you see this genotype, homozygous genotype, that shouldn't occur based on the genotypes of the parents, but in actuality, this genotype was caused by a sequencing error or just low read depth, and so you didn't have power to call the heterozygous genotype. And so this is just another reason why, instead of thinking about genotypes as discrete calls, it's really nice to be able to use genotype probabilities. And this concept has come up many, many times so far during this workshop. And so basically, from your read data, what you can do is generate genotype probabilities. If you're working with diploid organisms, there are 10 possible genotypes at a given site. So Alex mentioned that really, and if it's a diploid genotype, you really would just see 3 genotypes, right? But since we're also including sequencing error, we look at the probability of all 10, because it's possible you might have a third or fourth allele that's introduced because of error. And so what you hope to see is that you have really, really high probability for one genotype and really low probabilities for all the other possible genotypes. And basically, once you have genotype probabilities for all of your individuals, you can combine them with pedigree information to then have an assessment of how Mendelian is a particular trait. And so what we did was we borrowed from the human genetics literature the statistical framework for kind of quantifying the Mendelianness of a given SNP was developed several years ago. And so lesson number one, it's great to steal from the human genetics literature. They figured it out a long time ago. And all you have to do is tweak it a little to apply it to your own system. So let me walk you through that. What we do is we calculate the likelihood of a pedigree for a single family at a single site. And basically all this is the prior of the genotype. So this is simply the genotype probabilities for every single individual in the family multiplied by the transition probability. So here, that's simply the probability of the genotype of the offspring given the genotype of its two parents. And so you just multiply that for all. So here, S is the number of offspring in a family. And you just go and iterate through all possible genotype probabilities and all possible trios in a family. So this accounts for kind of, it's another way of propagating uncertainty since we're using the genotype probabilities for all possible genotypes. We also have a way of accounting for missing data. So if there's no genotype data for a given individual, what we do is we utilize allele frequencies calculated from the population and kind of substitute that in. And it's pretty flexible, so you can have families of different sizes. And one thing to keep in mind is that since a family with 2 offspring is going to give you much less information from a family with 10 offspring, if you sample multiple families, you need to normalize for the number of informative trios. And so in the end, what we get is a score for an individual pedigree, and it's just like the normalized pedigree likelihood. And if you sample multiple different nuclear families, you can just sum over all of them to obtain a composite score for a given site. And so what this score represents is kind of an assessment of how Mendelian a trait is. It's a fairly conservative metric because it integrates over multiple factors. So a really high scoring site not only needs to look Mendelian in most families, it also needs to have really low amounts of missing data and high genotype probabilities. So this is the theoretical framework. Does it work? It does. It works really well. So here I'm showing you simulation results. So we simulated 20 quartets, so 20 families with 2 parents and 2 offspring. And basically what I'm showing you here is the score for the SNPs. These are box plots for, I think we simulated, this is for like 1,000 sites. And I just increased the fraction of families that had a Mendelian error in them. And as you can see, as the fraction of families with the error increases, your score goes down. So this is behaving as we expected it to. You can also look at the effects of different parameters. So this was done just as a sanity check. So if your genotype qualities are really high, so here, these are simulation results for families, all of which contain an error. And so what you expect to see is all of these families should have really low scores. And so if you have high genotype quality, you do pretty well. Once your genotype quality deteriorates, your power to detect Mendelian errors decreases, which makes sense. Also, as the fraction of missing data increases, your power to detect errors decreases, because if you have no data, you really have no power to say whether or not a given site is Mendelian or not. So these are simulated data, and like it doesn't necessarily reflect reality. We wanted to know if it works with real data, and so we did genotyping by sequencing of my favorite organism. Oh, sorry, I forgot. So I've gotten this question a lot. What about experimental design? Is it better to sample like one family with lots of offspring or lots of families with fewer offspring? And so here I did simulations where there are 120 individuals total, and they can either be, you can either have 40 families with one offspring each, or up to like 10 families with 10 offspring each. And this result is a little counterintuitive at first, because you would expect that our power to detect Mendelian errors would increase with the number of meiosis. But here it actually decreases with the number of meiosis. And I think what's causing this pattern is that there's a lot of missing data in genotyping by sequencing. And so we wanted to make sure that we can incorporate that. And so our way of dealing with missing data was to estimate kind of a population allele frequency vector, basically. And so what we do is we take the genotypes, we take the genotype probabilities from the founders, and using all of that information, estimate the genotype probabilities that you would expect to see in this population. So I think that's why you actually gain more power if you have fewer families, so you have more founders, and therefore a better estimate of allele frequencies at a given site in the population. So, sorry, more families, fewer offspring per family, because this is assuming you have a trade-off in terms of the total number of individuals you can sample. Right, so simulation results. We sequenced it in the Florida Scrub Jay. I'm not going to talk very much about it, but if you are interested in learning about it, come talk to me. So what we did was we sequenced 107 individuals in 26 different nuclear families using genotyping by sequencing, and then ran the data through the pipeline I talked about yesterday and checked for Mendelian inheritance. So here on this, on the left, I'm showing you the number of SNPs after different sequential filters. So we started off, if you're filtering based on missing data, so we had about 28,000 SNPs that were genotyped in more than 80% of the individuals in our sample. If you then filter based on Hardy-Weinberg, you lose a tiny fraction of these. And this is the typical filter that you see. And this is after filtering for quality and read depth. This is kind of the typical filter that you see in published papers to date. And then if on top of that you then filter for Mendelian inheritance, what you see is that you lose quite a bit of your variance. And so what this shows here is that if you have family data and you can look for Mendelian inheritance, you'll do a much more rigorous job of filtering out the crap. So here I'm showing a folded site frequency spectrum. And in the red are the SNPs that just passed the Hardy-Weinberg filter, so SNPs from this bar in the bar chart. And in the white, I just overlaid the site frequency spectrum for the SNPs that passed our Mendelian filter. And it looks much more reasonable. And you can see that you throw out a lot of kind of low and intermediate frequency SNPs with the Mendelian inheritance filter. So this, yes.
So if something doesn't pass your checker, it's because you think you've sequenced it wrong, or because something's weird with that locus and it's not acting, it's biologically not acting.
So it could be filtered out for either of those reasons, and you would have to go in and look at the data to try to disentangle the two. So yeah. So it's possible that I'm filtering out true sites that are just either experience not segregating properly in natural populations, but it's...
But you're mostly doing it because to get rid of things you incorrectly call?
Yes.
Does the fact that there's a lot of things that aren't singletons that are getting filtered out suggest that it's not just errors, but just there's a large portion of things that are caused by cleanup of error?
Well, so I doubt that there are that many variants that are kind of undergoing some sort of segregation distortion in the population. One thing to note is that this metric, our metric of our Mendelian kind of quality score, is really, really stringent. And so we might be because we might just be adding on another level of filtering based on missing data and quality.
So another way to say that is you could set up a filter so that it's strictly getting things that are distorted in terms of segregation, right? It didn't include any data quality aspects, in which case you think you would see much less that's filtered out. If you're just filtering out segregation distortion.
Yeah. I think so, maybe. I haven't actually done it, so I don't know exactly. Yeah, just based on like biology, I don't think. From knowing the biology of my organism, I don't think there's that much segregation distortion going on. But we haven't looked, and so it's possible. Yeah, actually, I was surprised to see this because just based on theory, kind of, you expect that Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. So the Hardy-Weinberg test has fairly low power for rare alleles, so at really low minor allele frequencies, and I kind of expected to see more red at lower frequencies. But I also filtered based on minor allele frequency here before. It was one of the earlier filters, and so that might have messed things up a little. Okay. Any other questions so far?
I'm curious if you alter your assembly parameters, you can get those shapes look different.
It's possible. I mean, so the distribution will probably look different based on what upstream filters you use. I just picked an arbitrary set of read depth, or like not read depth, but I used mapping quality and other kind of genotype quality metrics that GATK spits out at you. It's totally possible that this might look slightly different.
Can you talk a little bit about what you think is happening with all those higher frequency alleles? Because I guess I was assuming if you're filtering out sequencing error, those are going to be low frequency alleles. And if you're filtering out homozygotes that you have insufficient data, you said insufficient data for call.
Well, but if you have, so this could be filtering out more paralogs, right? Where you have, if you have collapsed repeats, you would expect to see a lot of hets, and you might. So those variants are going to be at more intermediate frequencies, right? And it's possible, and if they're not segregating properly because they aren't. They're not real SNPs, then the metal checker will throw them out. Any other questions?
Yeah. Is this mostly getting rid of a genotype that's impossible in the offspring, or is it also, like, if for some reason all the offspring had the same genotype when they could have different genotypes, does it also filter those out?
So one thing to keep in mind is this isn't filtering based on this isn't filtering genotypes, it's filtering sites, loci, SNPs, if that makes sense, right? So at a given SNP, you have genotypes for all of your individuals. We're using information of the individual genotypes to assess the quality of a given site. if that makes sense. One thing to note is that you're depending on the kind of genotype configurations of the parents, you'll also have different abilities to distinguish errors, right? So if both of your parents are heterozygotes, like you, all four possible, you can have all four combinations of the two alleles in your offspring, and so you just can't, you just have no power to determine whether or not there's an error.
I guess that's what I was asking. If they were both, if parents are heterozygotes, then is this expecting the range in the offspring to like follow Hardy-Weinberg, or if they all end up being homozygous for something, is that like, well, those all are possible?
So it does take that into account because we, because the transmission probabilities for the different genotypes are different. So if you have two heterozygous parents, the transmission probability for an AA homozygote is smaller than for the heterozygote, and we take that into, that's incorporated in the model. So yes. And so if you had two heterozygous parents, so let's say you had two families with two heterozygous parents, one family had all homozygous offspring and one had kind of the expected 1:2 to 1 ratio, the one with the proper kind of ratio of offspring is going to have a higher score than the one with all homozygous offspring, because that's incorporated in the transition probabilities. So I'm curious, can anyone think of one thing that we're not doing with our model so far? Yeah.
It seems you don't incorporate, like, you could have a mutation on errors.
So the error, so sequencing error is incorporated in here because we're using the genotype probabilities, and we're just using the probabilities directly. It is true that if there are de novo mutations, like true de novo mutations in the offspring, that would look like an error here. So that was one of my caveats, was we're assuming no de novo mutations. So this works really well, but not all loci in your genome have the same transmission probability. So if you have, so sex-linked markers, so here I'm referring, birds are ZZ and ZW, so it's kind of flip-flop from XXXY sex chromosome systems. So in birds, males are ZZ, females are ZW. Markers on the Z chromosome or the X chromosome can be segregating properly and look like an error under an autosomal model of inheritance. So for instance, if you have a particular locus on the Z chromosome that's big A, and so the father is heterozygous for it, and the mother only has one copy of the Z and has the big A allele, you can get a female offspring can have just the little a allele and look like a little a homozygous. So if you were assuming autosomal transmission, this particular genotype configuration would be considered an error. But since we know it's sex-linked, it's actually not an error. And so sex-linked sites have different transition probabilities, and this creates a problem because you can have like good, valid SNPs on a sex chromosome that have different transition probabilities and therefore might be classified as an error, and you would be throwing out good data. And especially if you're interested, so Andy mentioned that there's a lot of cool stuff you can do with Z autosome or X autosome comparisons, this would be a big problem, because you would essentially be throwing out a lot of X-linked markers. So here I've just listed all possible genotype configurations for trios, so two parents and one offspring, and listed the transmission probabilities under an autosomal model of inheritance, or if the offspring is the homogametic sex, so XX or ZZ, and if the offspring is the heterogametic sex, so XY or ZW. You can see that the transition probabilities do differ between autosomal and sex-linked sites, and sometimes you can have cases where something would look impossible under an autosomal model, but is possible under a sex-linked model of transmission. And so we realized that it was really important to look for inheritance under a sex-link model as well. So the only, yeah, question.
So can you, if you're looking at this, then the dad and mom will also be homomimetic or heteromimetic, so if they're both heterozygotes, then this is not going to be an autosomal locus.
Yes, that is true. And that is, we take care of that in that you just have zero, they just come off as zero transition probabilities. So if you have mom as, so mom can never be a heterozygous, so the transition probability every time mom is heterozygous for a sex-linked site is zero, because it can't happen. So that's where that's incorporated in here. So the only difference between looking at autosomal sites versus sex-linked sites is this transition probability matrix, and so you can do the exact same, you can use the exact same framework, and all you have to do is substitute, so you include an additional parameter, so now the sex of the offspring matters. If you don't have the sex of the offspring, we just take the average between the two transition probabilities for heterogametic versus homogametic sexes, and calculate the sex-linked transmission probability. And if you run the simulations, this behaves just like the autosomal model. So a possibility then is, for since you have these different transition probabilities for particular genotypes, is it possible to then use the pedigree likelihoods to classify your sites as autosomal versus sex-linked? If you don't have a genome and you wanted, and you are interested in trying to do Z autosome or X autosome comparisons, it might be useful to know whether or not a particular site is sex-linked. And if you plot, so here I'm just plotting the autosomal pedigree likelihoods and the sex-linked pedigree likelihoods for, here are autosomal SNPs and here are sex-linked SNPs. This is simulation data. You can see that the pedigree likelihoods are different, and so you should be able to then look at the pedigree likelihoods and kind of classify SNPs as sex-linked, putatively sex-linked or not. This should look familiar to you. So basically, we use Bayes' theorem to calculate the posterior probability of being sex-linked given our data. And our prior here, the prior probability of sex linkage, we just use as kind of the estimated proportion of your genome that is on the sex chromosome. So for some organisms, you have no idea. For birds, we're lucky in that there have been genomes that are sequenced, so you just take the length of the Z chromosome and divide it by the length of the total genome, and that gives you your prior. And so it works pretty well. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip over the simulation results and just show you results from real data, because I didn't actually think it would work that well. And so this is pretty cool. So what I did here was I took the SNPs that were then filtered. So these are high quality SNPs, and mapped them to the zebrafinch chromosome, zebrafinch genome, in order to get chromosomal locations. In birds, there's pretty conserved syntony across chromosomes, and so we can do things like this. And here I have box plots of the posterior probability of sex linkage for all the sites on different chromosomes. And you can see that you have the Z chromosome, you have high probability of sex linkage, which is exactly what we want to see. On the bottom here, I'm just showing the proportion of sites that are classified as sex linked. So here I just picked an arbitrary threshold. And if you had a posterior probability above that threshold, you were classified as sex linked. And you can see that more than 60% of the SNPs on the Z were classified as sex-linked, which is, so it works, which is pretty good. There are definitely, so we wouldn't necessarily ever expect this number to be 100%, because there are sex-linked sites which look totally consistent with an autosomal model of inheritance, so you can't always tell if a particular site is sex-linked or not. But you do pretty well. Okay, so I just kind of really quickly ran you through our new framework for basically trying to filter out false variant calls in RadSeq or GBS data. And so we came up with this method that propagates genotype uncertainty and considers the probabilities of all 10 possible genotypes, is capable of accommodating missing data, which is a huge problem with RadSeq type methods, is pretty accurate for rare variants, and can perform a test of sex linkage for your sites. We're currently writing the paper for this, and our program is going to be will be posted online and made available for use. One nice side note is you don't necessarily need to learn how to program. What you can do is just collaborate with a programmer, which is what I did. So Srikanth wrote this program in C and came up with this fancy algorithm that really speeds up the process, because in calculating the pedigree likelihoods for large numbers of individuals and complicated and large numbers of offspring, the number of multiplications you have to do gets really large and is computationally slow, but he came up with this way to speed it up. And so this program can basically calculate pedigree likelihoods and the posterior probabilities of being sex linkage in a few minutes for thousands of SNPs and thousands of individuals. Yeah?
So on the graph you showed us where there was more red in the high frequency alleles that you might expect, could that be explained by sex linked genes being filtered out?
So for that, so when I did the filtering there, I already, because I was worried that I was filtering out sex-linked SNPs. And so the way we do this, the way I've been doing the filtering is, you take your SNPs, we calculate scores. So we calculate the score under an autosomal model of inheritance, the score under sex-linked inheritance, and the posterior probability. And so the first thing you do is take your kind of collection of SNPs, put them into two categories, putatively autosomal versus putatively sex-linked, and then look at the scores for the appropriate autosomal transmission and go from there. I kind of cheated in that graph, because I just took the maximum, so I compared the score under the autosomal model and the score under the sex-linked model and took the maximum score and then filtered based on the maximum score. But if you look at whether or not how that looks, the graph comes out pretty much the same. So if I just classified SNPs as sex-linked based on whether or not the sex-linked score was better than the autosomal score, you get something that looks like this, approximately. We haven't really developed thresholds yet for this, and so what we're doing, and I think what we're going to recommend, is that you simply rank order all of your SNPs and pick the top 10,000 or 5,000 or however many you think you need for your downstream analyses. Yeah?
Did you run some form of clustering analysis or PCA to show that there's really a difference between using only data that's only been filtered by Hardin Monroe versus using Mendelian sorting? Because, I mean, if you use if you're doing population genetics in subpopulations, and you're using organisms that are expensive to get the family tree,
right?
From the trend you show, it looks like it really doesn't make a lot of difference to. Really seem like it would be cost beneficial to do that type of analysis and then end up having the same type of structure.
Yeah, so I haven't actually done PCA yet. That's something that I need to do, I guess, maybe for the paper. One thing I can tell you is that I calculated average genome-wide levels of nucleotide diversity for the Mendelian filtered SNPs versus the not, and there's not that big a difference. So you're right, it's true that depending on what you're interested in, you can get away with not doing the Mendelian filtering. I would say that if high quality individual genotype calls are really important, then this would make a big difference. But I think it also depends on how extreme you are in the upstream filtering steps based on quality and missingness. So the answers might change depending on how stringent you are in other kind of criteria.
Have you thought about turning this entirely around and using the pedigree information to improve your confidence in low quality genotype calls?
So that is possible. We haven't actually done that with this particular framework, but yeah, if you have pedigree information, you can definitely use that to impute missing genotypes, and that's something we plan on doing later. It's not the same with this. Another possibility too is this program we output pedigree likelihoods for individual pedigrees. So if you sample multiple pedigrees and you think you might have an error, you can look at the pedigree likelihoods across sites and try to identify errors in your pedigree. And there's a whole statistical literature on using genotype information to try to identify errors in the pedigree or try to identify specific individuals that are not genotyped. We're just concerned with filtering sites and not necessarily genotypes. Yeah.
Did you go back from the sites that were filtered out and look at like their read depth and quality and stuff to see if they were different from unfiltered sites to see if there was maybe, if there's some sort of other quality metric that, like, do they both look like great sites otherwise, or?
I haven't done that yet because I just, like, did this. these data were generated fairly recently. But it's a great idea, and I will definitely do that and put that in the paper, which I'm currently writing. Other people have suggestions on things that need to go in the paper in order to convince reviewers that this is, like, the sexiest thing since sliced bread, let me know.
Yeah. Well, I think just to amplify on Lucia's point, the question of how close can you get to this with some stringent filter using this threshold that people are standardly doing, as opposed to making the effort to get pedigree data.
Yeah.
Presumably, you're going to be better at sorting out foci that are analogous clusters, right? And in some taxa, that's going to be a worse problem than others. And in some assemblies, that's going to be a worse problem than others. So I think it's... anything you do to help people evaluate how much is this improving your result relative to standard threshold filters?
It's going to help.
It's helping evaluate and use the tool and to make the extra effort to get better results.
Yeah, I thought about reanalyzing published data sets to see how far we would get. That's a lot more work. So I haven't decided if that's absolutely necessary yet. Because there are published data sets out there that we could apply our method to and see if we get different answers. I need to explore more with the ScrubJ data that we already have, just how important it is. For different downstream questions that you might have.
So I guess it's sort of following on from that. So most people who have pedigrees are doing mapping.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the filters that you do before you build a map is to remove any SNP genotypes that don't follow Mendelian inheritance. So it sort of happens automatically when people are doing mapping, and I'm wondering, maybe in some of those early RAD papers where they were mapping traits, maybe they talk about error rates, their Mendelian error rates, and how they move them. Maybe you get an estimate of maybe the amount of
Mendelian error
that
they see in their data.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that would, that's normally filtered out before you build enough, so.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is like, if you're not going to try to build a leakage trap, if you're gonna build a leakage trap, just go directly to that step and skip this. Because that's all gonna be, that's a better way if things aren't segregating properly and can't add it to your map. That does exactly what this is.
But you're taking into account, some information about redepths and
yeah, exactly.
I think when you're doing the mapping stuff, you're not just going, this skip doesn't follow the unit. Maybe going back to what he said about using it to inform, to make genotypes in wind patterns.
Yeah, that was one difference is, so there's this distinction about whether or not you consider genotypes as discrete entities, discrete calls versus kind of probability distributions. In most mapping software, you're correct in saying that you just throw in like hard genotype calls. So if you have a fuzzy genotype call, like you would, it's possible that you could use, so you could run things through the Mendel checker to figure out what accurate sites are, and then if you have inconsistencies in individual genotypes, you can then go back and correct it because you know from this that the site's good and it's probably just sequenced like a wrong genotype call for a particular individual at a particular site. So that's definitely a possibility.
We're gonna have to move on, and so
okay.
Maybe we can get a chance to, if you have more questions about this, ask Nancy at lunch.
No. Pedigrees are great, and you can do a lot more than just improve your genotype calls.